Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Drs. Ed Chu and Ken Miller. I'm Bruce Barber. Dr. Chu is Deputy Director and Chief of Medical Oncology at Yale Cancer Center, and Dr. Miller specializes in pain and palliative care. If you'd like to join the discussion, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu, and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. This evening, Ken Miller speaks with Dr. Robert Udelsman, Chairman of the Department of Surgery at Yale School of Medicine, and an internationally known specialist in the treatment of thyroid cancer.
The thyroid is a gland that sits in the front part of the neck, and it produces hormones called thyroid hormones, which are required for normal metabolism.
And what would happen if someone didn't have a thyroid or if it wasn't working well?
Yeah, so if, say your thyroid gland is removed surgically or simply doesn't work properly and the thyroid hormone production is inadequate, those people over time would have severe hormonal disturbances which result in lethargy, weight gain, and eventually, if it was severe, could actually result in their death.
Now, cancer can develop anywhere in the body. Can you tell us something about thyroid cancer?
Yeah, thyroid cancer is actually not that common of a cancer, although it seems to be increasing in incidence in the state of Connecticut. There are roughly 20,000 new cases of thyroid cancer diagnosed in the United States every year. And for the most part, it's a fairly indolent or slow-growing tumor, not nearly as aggressive as many other cancers.
Now, is it possible for someone to have thyroid cancer and actually where it never manifests itself, so they live a lifetime and it's never a problem?
It's actually not only likely, it actually comes quite commonly. So if you were to do autopsy series in elderly patients, say above 80 years old, you'd find a significant number of clinically insignificant thyroid cancers that have absolutely no clinical relevance.
You know, in some ways, it sort of reminds me of prostate cancer in that way.
It's exactly analogous. And in fact, they're both endocrine in origin, which is kind of interesting, isn't it?
That is. Is it more, you know, who develops thyroid cancer, men, women?
So actually, thyroid cancer is more common in women than men. There's about a 3-to-1 incidence increase in women compared to men. It develops in all age spans. It does occur in children, but it does increase with age, the probability of disease.
And any risk factors that we know of?
There are risk factors for thyroid cancer, particularly radiation therapy or radiation exposure as a child. So, for instance, back in the 40s and 50s, when external beam radiotherapy was used for things like acne and thymic enlargements, unfortunately, that treatment has resulted in an increased incidence in thyroid cancer 20 or 30 years later. In addition to that, because of accidents such as Chernobyl or other radiation exposure areas, those patients who were exposed, particularly as children, have a latency period where they develop thyroid cancer later in life.
All right. So, for example, if we talk about Chernobyl or, again, any kind of exposure like that, is the period between the exposure and developing the cancer, is it 10 years, 20 years?
Yeah, generally in decades. Mm-hmm. And it has a lot of other factors, the extent of exposure, the age of the time. But interestingly enough, the children are more likely to develop cancer, whereas an adult that gets a very high dose of radiotherapy, they don't develop thyroid cancer. They develop other forms of malignancies, mm-hmm. but not necessarily thyroid cancer.
One of my interests is cancer survivorship and people that have been through treatment for cancer. There's been many people that have been treated for Hodgkin's lymphoma, for example, where they had radiation. That was really meant for the chest, for example, or for the neck. But did they have to worry about that kind of thyroid problem or other thyroid problems they might develop?
They do, actually, because the mantle of radiation used in those Hodgkin's patients actually does result in significant radiation exposure to the thyroid glands. Most new protocols protect the thyroid gland, but there is scatter, and those patients are at risk. So it's kind of a funny issue, Ken, where we cure one cancer, mm-hmm. one malignancy, only to see other one develop down the road. But they are at risk for the rest of their lives, yes.
Right. In terms of screening, who would you consider as, and then we'll talk about what screening is, but who would you consider a high-risk people who should have increased screening?
So one other thing I failed to mention earlier, there also are certain familial or genetic syndromes associated with thyroid cancer. So by far and away, if you come from a family with a high incidence of thyroid cancer, all those children need to be screened, particularly if it's the familial forms. Interestingly, in the state of Connecticut, in addition to the more common medullary thyroid cancer, which occurs in families, there's an incidence of papillary thyroid cancer in Connecticut, which is actually of great interest to us as well as the Yale Cancer Center, and we're initiating a new screening program for some of those families. But what should you do? So if you're a child who was exposed, or it's your child who was exposed, they should be screened by their primary care doctor and perhaps by an endocrinologist. Fortunately, we have exquisite screening techniques, particularly a physical exam and a history, but ultimately an ultrasound examination can look at great detail of the thyroid gland, and if necessary, one can obtain a tissue diagnosis.
All right, so it sounds like the two parts of screening are physical. And how sensitive is a good physical exam?
A good physical by an experienced physician, particularly an endocrinologist who's experienced examining the thyroid gland, will pick up nodules greater than a centimeter in size. An ultrasound examination is far more sensitive, perhaps even too sensitive, because we'll see nodules down in the millimeter size, and it creates a dilemma for us if you screen patients. Should you biopsy all nodules even less than a centimeter in size? For the most part, we agree that anything greater than a centimeter should be biopsied, but smaller than that, I'm not sure it's necessarily appropriate in all patients to obtain a tissue diagnosis.
Now, yeah, just over the years in practicing medicine, a number of patients that I've seen have said, "Oh, I have a thyroid nodule." So, can you tell us a few? What are thyroid nodules? How common are they?
This is a good example where thyroid nodules are actually quite common. In fact, 15% of women in the United States have thyroid nodules, and yet very few of them have thyroid cancer. So we have a dichotomy there where we have a common incidence of the nodule disease, most of which are benign. So we have a standard algorithm how we work up these patients. Anyone with a thyroid nodule should be seen by an endocrinologist. A subset should obtain a tissue diagnosis, and that's usually done with a fine needle aspiration. It's a very simple test. A needle is placed into the gland, and we can look at the tissue under a microscope. The majority of those will have benign diagnoses and will only require follow-up and no surgery. A subset will have clear cancer, and they should have surgery. And an intermediate group will have indeterminate nodules. Mm-hmm. Creates great difficulty for us because we don't want to be overly aggressive, and yet we don't want to miss cancers.
All right. So maybe a very general kind of question, but of all the nodules that are found, what percent end up being cancer?
Well, the 1%.
Oh, it's very low.
A very small percentage of nodules actually are cancers. And in fact, if they have a large multinodular goiter with multiple nodules, it's unlikely to be a cancer. But there are some risk factors. For instance, if they have a single dominant nodule, particularly in a male patient, that's concerning to us. Mm-hmm. If they have a dominant nodule with history of radiotherapy for Hodgkin's disease, say they're now age 40 and they were treated for Hodgkin's at age 15, that would be worrisome to us. Right. So we can predict to some extent which nodules are high risk.
Now, in terms of biopsies, how are they done?
It's very simple in the vast majority of patients. Thank goodness for the Scandinavian countries, because in the 1950s, they really developed the technique of fine needle aspiration cytology. So we're able to put a needle into these nodules and obtain cellular specimens, and we can look at them under the microscope. Now, cytology is an art form, and this is an area I'm glad you asked me about, because the quality of both the aspirator, the person getting the sample, and the cytopathologist who looked at the sample is absolutely critical. And the average pathologist just doesn't have the training to look at these nodules. You need an expert cytopathologist to look at the specimen.
So essentially, the radiologist or the surgeon would take a thin, very skinny needle and basically take out cells.
That's absolutely right. And in fact, most patients tell me it's easier than having their blood drawn.
Okay, which actually, so this is not a painful procedure particularly?
I wouldn't say it's a pleasant procedure, but on the range of painful procedures, this is very low and extraordinarily well tolerated. It's often done under ultrasound guidance because with an ultrasound machine, you can put that needle exactly in the nodule and be certain you're getting a good specimen.
Can you tell us a little bit about, someone's had a biopsy, what are the different types of thyroid cancer? And then we'll have a chance maybe in the second portion to sort of focus on some of them.
Okay. So again, the majority of biopsies will be benign, showing a multinodular goiter or hyperplastic nodule. Those are not what our conversation's about. Of the thyroid cancers, there are four primary thyroid cancers. I'll just say the names of them. They're papillary, follicular, medullary, and anaplastic. I'll also say that the third most common malignancy of the thyroid gland is not anaplastic. It's actually primary thyroid lymphoma, which is an interesting subgroup. But of those thyroid cancers, that is papillary and follicular, they're by far the most common and comprise about 85% of all thyroid cancers. It's also nice to say that almost all of those patients can be cured of their disease with appropriate treatment. So we consider those well-differentiated thyroid tumors. There are subsets within both papillary and follicular which act more aggressively, and there's more subsets of those, and they need more aggressive treatment. The medullary thyroid cancers comprise 10 or 15% of which About half and half of which are familial, that is genetic abnormal cancers, or sporadic, that just occur sporadically in the community. And they're an interesting and unusual subtype that we have a particular interest in. And finally, the anaplastic cancers are extremely aggressive, and many patients will actually succumb to their disease in spite of exquisite treatment. And finally, thyroid lymphoma, for the most part, that's a non-surgical disease. Mm-hmm. The surgeons come in the role to help make the diagnosis, but those patients do extremely well with non-surgical treatment.
Actually, so thankfully, most of the types of thyroid cancer, including lymphoma, are curable.
Absolutely.
Which is great. So let's focus for a couple minutes on medullary, since, as you say, there's a higher incidence perhaps in Connecticut than elsewhere. Can you give us an example of a family you've taken care of where you made that diagnosis of it being familial?
So we have many families. It comes in three basic varieties in the familial forms. It consists of MEN2A, MEN2B, and isolated familial cancer of the thyroid, medullary cancer of the thyroid.
So what's MEN?
MEN stands for multiple endocrine neoplasia. So it's quite interesting that these patients have multiple endocrine abnormalities. For instance, not only do they have medullary cancer of the thyroid, they develop rare tumors of their adrenal glands called pheochromocytomas, and they develop tumors of their parathyroid glands, which are glands in the neck as well. That's an MEN2A. Mm-hmm. In MEN2B, they develop lesions of their tongue or the mucosa throughout their gastrointestinal tract. They also do not develop hyperparathyroidism, but they do develop pheochromocytomas, and they have very aggressive medullary cancers of the thyroid. These medullary cancers are really quite unusual. They're very different than the garden variety papillary follicular because they're derived from a different kind of cell called the C cell, which produces a very rare a hormone called calcitonin. Mm-hmm. Now, the beauty of it is we can use the calcitonin as a tumor marker. So we can know with very high degrees of confidence whether the patients are cured or whether they develop a recurrence by measuring these tumor markers.
All right. So, for example, within a family, would this be all the daughters would have it, all the sons would have it?
So this is a classic autosomal dominance inheritance pattern, which means 50% of the children will develop it, and there is no predilection for boys or girls. Okay. Many people don't understand this. Each new birth is a flip of the coin. So you could have three children who have it, and the next one may or may not have it, but they're independent risk factors. So the fact that three have had it does not mean that the next one is spared. Or you could have three children who don't get it. It's an independent flip of the coin every time a child is born.
If someone has a family history of medullary thyroid cancer, is there a test that they can have done to know if they're at risk?
Yeah. This is a great example of where medicine has really pushed us so far forward. There's now a genetic test for these families, and it's called the RET proto-oncogene. And we can measure these proto-oncogenes with great confidence. And if you have it positive and we know the genetic abnormality, we can predict with near 100% certainty whether the child has it or not. That's incredibly important because if we know the child has it, even if the child is asymptomatic and has no nodules, we're going to recommend surgery in early phase, and we can cure those patients with a high degree of confidence. So an example where a genetic marker can result in a treatment paradigm that can result in a preemptive curative procedure, and the child will be protected for the rest of their lives.
So you're saying a preventative procedure before a cancer even develops?
Absolutely. So if we know the child has a genetic abnormality, we're going to recommend surgery, even though the gland, the ultrasound of the thyroid gland, looks normal, because we know that the incidence of disease approaches 100% in these patients. And if we intervene at a young enough in age, usually in MEN2A, around 5 or 6 years of age, we can cure virtually all of these patients.
So, you know what? I mean, what a wonderful thing to prevent a cancer from developing.
It's a beautiful example of medical science. And I just want to mention the name Sam Wells, who really is the guy who really early on developed the calcitonin stimulation test and has pushed us to develop these curative things in these children.
Well, we'd like to remind our listeners to please email your questions to us at canceranswers@yale.edu. We're going to take a short break for a medical minute, and then please stay tuned to learn more information about thyroid cancer with Dr. Robert Udelsman from the Yale Cancer Center.
It's estimated that over 2 million men in the U.S. are currently living with prostate cancer. 1 in 6 American men will develop prostate cancer in the course of his lifetime. Major advances in the detection and treatment of prostate cancer have dramatically decreased the number of men who die from this disease. Screening for prostate cancer can be performed quickly and easily in a physician's office using two simple tests, a physical exam and a blood test. Clinical trials are currently underway at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers like the one at Yale to test innovative new treatments for prostate cancer. Patients enrolled in these trials are given access to experimental medicines not yet approved by the Food and Drug Administration. This has been a Medical Minute, and you'll find more information at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum from Connecticut Public Radio.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Ken Miller, and I'm speaking today with Dr. Robert Udelsman from the Yale Cancer Center about the treatment and treatment options for patients with thyroid cancer. Rob, why don't we start talking about the phase after someone's been diagnosed. What is the primary form of treatment for thyroid cancer?
There are three fundamental treatments for thyroid cancer: surgery, radiotherapy, and long-term TSH suppression, thyroid-stimulating hormone suppression by administering thyroid hormone. But let me start with the surgery, which is the primary and initial treatment. So thyroid cancer develops in the thyroid gland, and the primary treatment is to remove the thyroid gland. If it were so easy, everybody would be doing it. Mm-hmm. It's actually not difficult to remove a thyroid gland. What's difficult is to remove the thyroid gland and not injure associated structures like the recurrent nerves, the nerves to the vocal cords, other nerves, and the sensitive parathyroid glands. And that's why patients do better when they're referred to an expert thyroid surgeon.
All right, so you're saying even though it's easy to take it out, it's hard to take it out well.
That's exactly right, Ken. It's a technical exercise done by people who do it with expertise, who do it day after day. And there are good data out there that if your thyroid surgeon isn't performing at least 100 thyroidectomies a year, one could argue that they may not be the right one to send your patients to.
Okay. A cancer operation for the thyroid as opposed to just removing the thyroid for when there's not cancer. How is it different?
It is a different operation. Our goal in thyroid cancer surgery is to remove not only the abnormal portion of the thyroid gland, but the normal thyroid tissue as well. Because in well-differentiated thyroid cancer, most patients will receive radioactive iodine treatment. And if you leave a lot of tissue behind, it makes the treatment more difficult.
All right. And absolutely, it's a perfect segue to talk about radioactive iodine. Can you explain for all of us, I mean, how does that work? Why does it work?
It's a miracle, Ken.
Ooh, that sounds good.
It's a miracle because thyroid hormone is made by taking iodine from the diet, incorporating it in the thyroid cell, and producing thyroid hormone. That's why we have T4 and T3. T4 is how many iodine molecules are in there. T3 has 3, T4 has 4. Mm-hmm. So since we have this very unique situation where iodine is used, we take advantage of that by making iodine radioactive, which we call I-131, radioactive iodine. And then we can give the patient radioactive iodine, which is in fact a magic bullet. And it goes to thyroid cells with such a high degree of specificity that it spares normal tissues, mm-hmm. with issues of about 1,000-to-1 therapeutic ratio compared to normal tissues. This is in contradistinction to external beam radiotherapy, mm-hmm. which basically will injure any rapidly dividing cell. So we can take advantage of that specificity and give very high doses with great safety. And that's what our radiotherapists do.
I mean, it's interesting. We've talked a lot on this show about targeted therapy, and yet it sounds like radioactive iodine might have been one of the first.
It sure is, and it's one of the most targeted therapies by pure chance alone that we can take advantage of the fact that we have a very specific molecule, the iodine, that's specific to the thyroid gland. If only we had such molecules for pancreatic cancer and esophageal cancer or lung cancer. Unfortunately, we try to, but we really don't.
Yeah. How do you decide after you've operated on someone, you get the pathology report back, you're sitting and talking with them, how do you decide or recommend who needs the radioactive iodine and who doesn't?
I'm so glad you asked me that question. I want to emphasize it's not a unilateral decision. It's a group decision between the surgeon, the endocrinologist, and the radiotherapist, where we talk together and say, you know, this is a very high-risk patient or this is a low-risk patient. So for instance, if we remove a thyroid gland for Graves' disease, a benign condition, and we find a 0.1 centimeter thyroid cancer, mm-hmm. we do not treat that patient. All we do is put them on thyroid hormone and recommend routine follow-up with an expert endocrinologist. Mm-hmm. They do not need additional treatment. On the other hand, if the patient has a thyroid cancer that's greater than a centimeter in size, close to a margin, multicentric in multiple locations, and particularly if they have positive lymph node involvement, then we will treat that patient with radioactive iodine therapy. And so you see, the pathology helps us make those decisions.
How's it given? And I think the next thing I want to get onto is what are the side effects? People always ask.
So radioactive iodine is actually quite safe. It's given orally, usually in the form of a liquid. The radiopharmacist can design a cocktail that's very specific to the patient and can dose it with exquisite accuracy. So we know exactly how much we're giving, and we can predict the effects. So for instance, if a patient has localized disease that's not beyond the thyroid gland, we give a relatively low dose, perhaps 29 millicuries. If, on the other hand, they have metastatic disease to their lungs, we would give a higher dose in the goal of curing that patient. And believe it or not, in thyroid cancer, unlike other diseases, lymph node involvement and even metastatic disease to lung and bones does not mean that they don't have a curative option. And in fact, our goal truly isn't cure. Our goal is that they should outlive their disease. So if they were to die with disease but live to age 90 or 95, then we've probably done a pretty good job. Another basic principle is the treatment should not be worse than the natural history of the disease itself.
Which is a good principle in general in oncology. So, it's interesting. We don't use the word cure a lot in oncology, and I think we should more than we do. But so let's go back to the patient where the cancer has spread. You know, let's say they come in, they have thyroid cancer, and it's a small number of people where it's gone elsewhere. Are those patients able to be cured of that disease or to outlive the disease?
The answer is yes. So we see children with metastatic disease to their lungs, and they will enjoy essentially normal lifespans. Mm-hmm. Are they cured? That's a debatable issue. Are they in remission for decades? Absolutely. And so, yes, some are cured and some are in remission, but if they outlive the disease, it's not that important to us as long as they do so well. On the other hand, we also see aggressive disease that will decrease lifespans. So it's that balance between giving the treatment that's appropriate for the individual.
All right, it sounds like for some patients with a papillary or follicular cancer, they would have surgery, perhaps radioactive iodine. Let's go back to medullary cancer, which I know you have tremendous expertise in. And what's new at the Yale Cancer Center in terms of treatment for those patients?
Yeah. So the first thing I want to emphasize, the primary treatment for medullary cancer is surgery. And the more aggressive the initial surgery, the better, because these have early predilection for lymph node metastases. So in medullary, we recommend not just a total thyroidectomy, which we do. We also recommend a variety of lymph node dissections, either the central neck or what we call a modified radical neck dissection. And they're tricky because they can have microscopic disease in these lymph nodes. They look totally normal in imaging, but we know the incidence of metastatic disease to the lymph nodes is actually quite high in these patients. However, once they've had surgery and they've done relatively well, but they have elevated calcitonin and or CEA levels, which is another tumor marker postoperatively, we know with virtually 100% confidence they have residual disease. Mm-hmm. Then the question is what to do for them. Should we be operating them? Perhaps so. Perhaps you should do a lymph node dissection. But at the Yale Cancer Center, we have a new trial that's being run. The principal investigator is Julianne Sosa. It's a trial in cooperation with a drug company called AstraZeneca. And it's a very incredible and interesting concept in that it's a tyrosine kinase inhibitor, a drug that inhibits this tyrosine kinase inhibitor. And the early data are extraordinarily promising. And the toxicity of the drug is really quite minor compared to other drug trials where there can be significant toxicities. So we're involved in both a familial form of trial for this drug mm-hmm. as well as the more recent sporadic trial, and the patients are doing quite well, and we're very excited about this trial.
So this would be a pill in a sense, and when it's absorbed through the bloodstream, it sounds like it turns off an enzyme in cancer cells, and to the patients feel better, or is it you're seeing a change? Are the tumors shrinking? What kind of results
are you seeing? So both. We're actually seeking. The first thing we see is a decrease in the calcitonin and CEA levels. So again, we have this exquisite tumor marker we can follow, and these levels fall. But in addition to that, we image these patients. And in some patients, we're seeing dramatic shrinkage of their tumors. In tumors, in some cases, where there really is no other treatment available. Mm-hmm. So I have a couple of my patients who Dr. Sosa is treating now in collaboration with her oncology colleagues and the Yale Cancer Center, particularly Harry Deshpandian. Help me with that name again.
That's it?
Okay. And it's remarkable. It's remarkable how in two of my patients in particular with widespread disease, they're doing remarkably well with this drug treatment.
I have to say we've been fortunate in other parts of oncology. Chronic leukemia is now treated with a tyrosine kinase inhibitor, a different one called Gleevec. But, you know, hopefully we'll have more treatments like that for other types of cancer as well.
It's really quite remarkable because it's a new concept of chemotherapy where it's not the traditional kinds of chemotherapy that have a fair amount of toxicity. And these patients, by the way, really do have a lot of complications of their disease. I have one poor patient out in Pennsylvania who's not doing as well. And, you know, they develop local airway problems, and it's really devastating when you can't control the local disease.
So hopefully chemotherapy would be a pill.
Yeah.
Maybe quite helpful. How about for the other type of cancer, anaplastic cancer?
Yeah.
What's new in that field?
So anaplastic is a devastating tumor. The majority of patients ultimately will die of their disease, no matter how aggressive we are surgically or medically. And we're actually interested in starting a new trial in anaplastic thyroid cancer for a variety of reasons. One is these patients need to go to a tertiary medical center for a whole variety of reasons. And it's a collaborative effort between surgeons, oncologists, as well as radiotherapists. And we're actually interested in starting a new trial. We're just in the early phases of organizing this trial. And once again, Dr. Sosa is the primary investigator. I think she's a co-investigator, again, with Harry in the Medical Oncology Center. And it's a good example where surgeons and medical oncologists are working side by side. It's important to have surgeons because we're the ones who see the patients, but we recognize we're not going to cure the majority of these patients. And medical oncologists have expertise that we don't in managing these patients.
Sure. I want to talk a little bit about, again, people that have had surgery for thyroid cancer go on hormone replacement therapy. How do you regulate that? How do you, and is that well tolerated? What are the side effects of that? Again, these are questions that patients ask.
They sure do. And everybody has both conceptions and misconceptions about thyroid hormone. Fortunately, we know exactly what thyroid hormone is. We know its chemical structure, and we can give it with exceedingly confidence at what the right doses are. And the reason is there's an internal thermostat. The internal thermostat is the pituitary gland. So when you administer thyroid hormone, the pituitary gland will respond by changing the levels of TSH. Mm-hmm. And therefore, we can regulate it in every individual patient. It's the ultimate of individualized patient care. Mm-hmm. And we can get the exact right dose based on their TSH levels. And this is, again, managed by our endocrinology colleagues. And there's virtually no patient we can't figure out the right dose.
I've heard a few patients have said, geez, you know, I take the thyroid medicine, but I still don't feel like
right.
I did before. So my question is, does the thyroid make other things?
Yeah, it does. And in fact, there's more than one thyroid hormone. Mm. The fact is the thyroid gland makes a combination of thyroxine, T4, as well as T3. And it's a combination of the two in normal glands that's controlled. But the fact of the matter is T4, thyroxine, is converted to T3 in the periphery. So generally speaking, mm-hmm. and for the majority of patients, we administer T4 alone. However, particularly in the psychiatric literature, there is at least some thought that you really want to recapitulate normal physiology as much as possible. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And some patients are giving a combination of T4 and T3, which we call Cytomel, which is the drug that we administer. I'm not sure for the vast majority of patients there's great efficacy for giving the combination of drugs because, again, T4 is converted to T3. It's T3 that's the active drug that actually has the action. But some patients are given a combination of the two drugs. It's less convenient. The beauty of T4 is it has a long half-life, which means that if you miss a dose, it's okay.
Okay.
If you're going away for the weekend and you forget your bottle and you're across that bridge, just keep on driving. It'll be okay to miss a couple of doses. And for patients, this is a wonderful thing. Because as you know, compliance is directly related to the ease of the medication.
Absolutely true.
Fortunately, though, patients like to take their thyroid hormone because when they don't take their thyroid hormone, they feel bad. So they tend to take their medicines. Unlike other medicines like antihypertensive medicines, the drugs can actually make them feel worse, even though the drugs are good for them.
Well, actually, this has been a wonderful discussion about thyroid cancer and actually a pretty uplifting one in terms of really all the progress that's been made. I want to thank you, Dr. Robert Udelsman, for joining us on the Yale Cancer Center Answers program.
It's really been a great fun for me to be here. I'd like to emphasize that thyroid cancer, like many diseases, involves multiple doctors across disciplines. It's a true thing that a cancer center can do the best because it's different levels of expertise that help the patients.
And basically from all of us, from Dr. Udelsman and myself and Dr. Ed Chu, who is off this week, we'd like to wish you a safe and healthy week.
If you have questions, comments, or would like to subscribe to our podcast, go to yalecancercenter.org, where you'll also find transcripts of past broadcasts in written form. Next week, Ed and Ken speak with Barbara Oliver about Why Me, Connecticut.